Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be European and live in the UK. We're trying to understand Europe and our position in it, one document at a time.
Oh, I'm supposed to say that so that we don't get sued. I think that's what my partner worries about. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to use your name or whatever. So,
well, introductions come now. I'm Carola Böhm, European.
Oh, okay, I can.
European, German, wife, mother, academic, and living here in the UK.
And with me, I am Richard McCarthy. I'm a man. I'm British. I'm European. I'm an ex-energy auditor. It's got down there. Ex-school teacher. Yeah, that's me.
And so we're drifting. We're still dithering, aren't we? We're still dithering.
Yeah, I think I dither more than you do, but so to speak.
Yeah. So just to get us off started in the right place. Today is the 12th of May, 2019. Last month, we were supposed to have left the EU.
Yeah, or even the month before that.
Almost more than a month ago.
Definitely a month more than a month ago. 29th of March, we were supposed to leave. Then it was supposed to be the 12th of April.
Wow. And now?
Then it was supposed to be the 23rd of May, which looks like it's not going to happen, thank goodness.
So dithering is the right way to describe it then.
Yeah, wavering on the edge, maybe.
Wavering on the edge. And now, of course, we're voting in the European elections.
Hooray!
I've voted, actually, already. Have you?
Yeah, I know. Well, no, because I don't have a postal vote. You know that.
So I voted with my postal vote. So we thought, because we're in the middle of the European elections, we thought we would look at the European Parliament. And there are three documents that we wanted to have a look at. And they sound, one of them sounds quite boring, I should say. So one of them.
You mean one of them? Carola reads, gets a lot more out of what she reads than I do.
Really. Right, okay. Well, one of the documents is Annex 1. Starts off very exciting.
That one really got me going.
But. Exactly. Code of conduct for members of the European Parliament with respect to financial interests and conflicts of interest.
Yeah.
And then the second document is actually the guidance that the European Commission puts on their website in relation to the European Parliament. So it's just guidance about how members of the European Parliament are elected, the elections in detail, the political parties, which we're going to talk about. And then as the third source of information, we've got trusty Wikipedia, which we can refer to the bigger picture to. And I think actually Richard has done a bit of research himself. So we each
I can occasionally do that.
We each chose 3 points that we wanted to just explore a bit. So what was your first point?
My first point was, because bear in mind your points, my first point was the actual system of deciding who is elected and who isn't. So it's called the de Hondt system or the Jefferson system or the highest average system, or has a bunch of other names apparently, right, depending on the first proponent in that country.
So. Okay, so the de Hondt system, of course, is the way we create a proportional representative election
allocation
process
of representatives.
Right.
Okay, but are we not going to go through with the other things first?
No, I thought we'd just do it point by point.
All right. Well, we've done 1 point, 1 point, 2 points. You're on your second point. Now we're going to start with your second point. Is that right? I thought maybe we were going to introduce all of our 3 points each, and
no,
then we were going to go back to the first point.
Well, I think for the listeners, it might be more interesting just to say, so what was your second point 10 minutes into?
Right, okay. Whereas you get to say your second point straight away.
No, but
because it's linked to my first point.
It is, actually.
That's why.
Because, I mean, the strange thing about the election systems is that each country might have different election systems. That's as far as I understood it from the documents.
They could have, not vastly different. And in actual fact, they aren't very different, I think.
Well, I think the European Union puts only 2 guidelines there. Proportional representation.
Yeah.
The system must be a form of proportional representation under either the party list or the single transferable vote system.
Yeah.
And then the second point, the electoral area may be subdivided if this will not generally affect the proportional nature of the electoral system.
Yeah, I think that's a very sort of element to Britain's division, to be honest.
You know, and I find that quite interesting because it's a very sensitive way of keeping country sovereignty, so nation sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So each nation can choose their way. They elect their European Parliament representatives. Yeah. But at the same time, there are common principles that all have to adhere to.
Yeah, it does have to have some form of proportional representation, which is good.
Yeah, which, you know, I assume other countries, I don't know what the voting systems in other countries are, but I would wager that the majority of them have proportional representation and not...
Well, they've got to have. They've all got to have.
No, not just for
their normal
elections. For the normal elections.
Most of them do seem to have proportional representation, yes.
But that's actually quite nice. So we have, and you mentioned it already, the Dahond system, which results in proportional representation.
Yeah, I think most countries use either the Dahond system or the Jefferson system or the highest average system.
Now, I've never heard, I mean, in the recent weeks I've heard about the Dahond system, but beforehand I've never heard about the Dahond system before.
No, but you have in a way, because it's very, very similar to the system used in the Scottish Parliament for electing the additional members. Although the additional members, that's a sort of Dahond plus system. So what happens is you take the number of votes cast for each party. So it's basically, you vote for a party, you don't vote for individuals. Although we've seen on your election paper, it was individuals on the paper along with their party name.
Yeah, that's
apart from
right.
one, I think, yeah. who was just if they're independent,
well, they were
lists. It's just their name.
You know, similar to the Scottish Parliament system, you have a list. But I think that the Scottish Parliament system was strangely, you know, it had two parts of it. On the one hand, you could vote for people, for individuals. And on the other hand, you had a list system where you voted for the party.
So the Scottish system has first past the post, but also they have five regions and there are an extra, is it five members of parliament, Scottish members
so
of parliament for each region.
That second part, which is the Dahond, more like
it's
the Dahond system. Dahond plus.
The Dahond system.
Sorry, who's got Dahond plus, Scotland or Europe?
Scotland and Wales for those elections, they have the Dahond plus.
What does the plus stand for?
The plus is because since they also have first past the post, the Dahond system says... You divide by, you take each party and you divide by their number of votes by one plus the number of people who've already been elected to the position for that party.
Right.
So if you've got a region with six people being elected, you look at the number of the number of votes for each party. The party with the highest number of votes gets their first person elected.
Right.
And then you look at them again, but this time, let's call that Party A. Party A has its number of votes divided by two, because it's one plus one.
Right.
I've got an example here.
So they get redistributed proportionally.
Well, their number of votes gets changed. Every time somebody gets elected for a party, then the number of continuing votes for that party, if you like, are changed are reallocated by being divided by one plus the number of people already elected for that party.
Right.
And that way, the idea is that it gives you a fairer representation of people. But it only starts making it fairer once you get into the high levels, to be honest, frequently. But I haven't had apparently it does favour large parties, the Dahond system.
Yeah.
There's a couple of other things which are a bit technical to go into, but the big thing is that it does favour large parties rather than small parties or medium-sized parties.
I think, and I don't know how the mathematics work out, but I think we've heard in a different podcast that you have to have at least...
Well, it depends.
How much of the vote in order to be...
Well, it's
count to it's, count 16% of the vote. Wasn't so high 16% of
the
vote.
It's higher than that in some places. That's the whole thing, is that it depends on how many people are being elected for that region.
Right.
So the minimum number of people being elected in a region in the UK is three, which is the case for the North East region, and it's also the case for Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland is fine because that's STV, which is single transferable vote. So you just say, I want Mr. A or Mrs. A or Ms. A as my first vote. And then if should she or he be the last person on the list, be the person with the least votes, I will transfer my votes then to person B. And should then person B be the lowest number of votes on the second count or third count or whatever, then my votes get transferred to person C, and so on and so on, which is fantastic. It seems to me like the most sensible way of doing any kind of election. But anyway, so Northeast, because there's three people being elected, what you do to find out the minimum, the sort of absolute minimum that you need, the minimum to make sure, to guarantee that you get a person voted, is divide by that number plus one. So that means 100% divided by 3 plus 1.
Right.
100 divided by 4, so 25%. You need to get 25% to guarantee that you get elected. It could be that you'd be elected with something lower like 20% or 16%.
And that's, of course, very difficult for the smaller parties to even have a chance.
Absolutely.
And that's why there was a discussion that why don't the smaller parties like the Green Party, the TIG party, the Change UK party, why can't they...
Get together.
But I think that was so late in the day, you know, having thought about it, you know, I think it's so difficult because you've got a democratic process within the party to actually confirm that. And I think there just wouldn't have been enough time with the establishment of Change UK to
I think it's possible. Well, also Change UK is made up of people from parties that don't do that. Change UK is made up of people from the Labour Party, don't want to do it. And the Conservative Party, they don't want to do it either.
Yeah, exactly.
So they don't believe in that kind of stuff.
Right. But before I see you're looking at your paper, your math eyes, your math teacher eyes are already looking at that. And you could, you know,
I was going to give it a couple of other examples. That was all. One thing I was going to say on the those voting, I mean, the Northeast and Yorkshire and Humber are very right next to each other. They're both not very large areas. The Northeast gets three elected people.
Right.
And Yorkshire and Humber gets six. And it would, for me, it's like, why aren't they combined to have nine?
Yeah.
But that might be
strategy, because that's up to the country to decide.
Yeah. That's,
so the country could say, we want just to have one big region and we're going to decide how we vote within that region. Or they could decide we're going to have sub-regions.
Yeah. And I think so it's largely decided by... Conservatives and Labour.
Yeah.
And the more they divide the country up into regions, the more they're going to get, the more they get favoured by proportional representation.
Absolutely. And can I just ask, you know, we don't have that term, but of course Americans have the term gerrymandering. Do we have that term here in Britain as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which,
and
of course,
it does happen, certainly in the UK.
So gerrymandering, of course, changing the boundaries to... in such a way that you have an advantage as a party, that the electorate, that it shifts the outcome of the result.
But I don't think we have that. It's very easy to just say, oh, well, it's not as bad here as it is in America. But I really don't think it is as bad. In America, it's awful.
Yeah.
Here, there have been some cases of it, certainly, I think. But just quickly, in terms of, we were talking about the percentage of votes that you needed to get to definitely make sure you got elected in different areas. So in the Northeast, for example, you've got to get 25% to make sure that you get elected. Whereas in the Southeast, where they are electing 10 people, you've only got to get 9% of the vote to make sure you get elected. So that means smaller parties should be much more favoured in the Southeast. It's about the same sort of area, I think, as Northeast. It's also possible to have either a closed list or an open list with
the
system.
So what's the difference?
The closed list is when you don't see who's the top of the party list and the second and third and so on.
So that's the way the voting systems are decided by each nation. And then there's an allocation of seats. laid down within European Union treaties. And that was when I was reading some of the documents, like the result of decades of evolution of different treaties. And of course, adjustments during that time, because of course the European Union started off smaller, but that they have something which I guess they've called, or that we call, digressive proportionality principle, which means that smaller countries are actually, in terms of the number of seats that they have in the European Union, are disproportionately larger represented.
Yeah, well, I think that's perfectly fair, really.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, you know, they just wouldn't get any kind of a look in. You do need to have, you couldn't have a country coming in and only having one MEP, because that would be grossly unfair. So it's very important to have a few, at least.
So did you have a look at this infographics, European elections in 2019, which showed how many seats each country gets, but also if the UK leaves, how additional seats would be allocated? Did you have a look at that?
I did, and that was interesting. But, you know, I think it's basically on population, but you see that Germany with 96 votes, I think, compared to our 73, when you think that Germany has a population of about 90 million, I think, 95 million, compared to our 66 million. So you can see, obviously, they should get more votes, but if it was just done proportionally, then the difference, they'd have more extra votes than
we
get.
So that's the digressive proportionality principle. And of course, that's actually quite nice, because smaller member states count, you know, their vote counts. And although, I guess, until Brexit happened, nobody was talking about European elections, certainly in this country, but also in Germany, you know, was probably more important than the UK, but it was never considered a really big thing. But I think Brexit has foregrounded it now, and until...
Well, maybe. I think there's an awful lot of people who love or hate Brexit and can't be bothered to think about the European elections, other than who's standing in their area. And we've looked at it an awful lot more than we have looked at it in the past.
Yeah.
But mainly partly because of this, really, isn't it?
Exactly. And we, you know, we had to admit to ourselves that we didn't even know the voting systems that were being used. Now, what I found interesting in terms of this infographics, and we can put a link to it in our show notes, was that they actually, so the European Union decided not to reallocate all the seats. So the United Kingdom had 73 seats in the, you know, during the
2014
elections. And of course, if we do exit, that will be math teacher.
It's only going to go down by 46. Well, the number of seats in the parliament is going to go down by 46. So that means an extra 27. Is that right? 27.
Well,
are going to be reallocated, and 46 are just going to disappear.
Yeah. And so, for instance, Germany is not going to win any because they have the maximum number. But Spain and France will each get 5 additional seats. And when I was thinking about that, of course, that means that they have the biggest interest of the UK leaving, because they would get 5 more seats.
But
the other discussion that might be had after the European elections, because, of course, this allocation model was based on the fact that there were certain countries, because of their now contemporary measurement of the size of the populations, were underrepresented. And that's why two countries get 5 more seats. I think a couple get 3 more seats, and then a spatter of countries get 1 more seat. That is based on some evidence. So even if the UK stays, there would now be the question, how do we address the underrepresentation of specifically Spain and France? Because that has now been acknowledged through this process.
Yeah, I presume that what happens is they have to relook at this every 5 years, certainly every 10 years. But it would maybe it relies on censors. census, you know, it needs census information, I presume, for that as well.
Well, I mean, just when we looked at the Wikipedia entry, there were several times where there was a consideration of the number of seats. One was 2007, one was 2009, 2014. So there are times where they look at the proportion of seats in the parliament. Right, so that was one point. What was your second point?
My second point was, I think I've already mentioned it, and that was, why is it that North East and Yorkshire and Humber aren't combined into one region?
Right.
And feasibly, I'm a bit of a numpty. That's very feasible. And the North East and Yorkshire and Humber, you know, there's a big reason if I live there that people would say, oh, don't be ridiculous. How can we possibly have election with combining these two areas or regions? That would be ridiculous. That would be just stupid. But I would think that the size of the regions combined would seem to be, just by looking at the map, about the same as the size of the regions in the Northwest region. So if that can be combined to being eight, why can't those two be combined to being nine?
Yeah.
And I think it's because it's a bit of a stitch-up, to be honest, because if it doesn't get combined, then more Conservatives, more Labour get elected as MEPs.
Right.
Possibly.
My second point was similar to your first point about eligibility criteria. So again, you know, each country can specify their eligibility criteria. And of course, I looked up Germany and the UK. So what happens if I, myself, a German citizen, mm-hmm. but resident with permanent residency rights in the UK, what if the UK leaves the European Union? So in terms of voter eligibility as a German, there are 2 points. A European Union citizen aged 18 or over on polling day resident in Germany, if they are resident in member states of the European Union for at least 3 months. So that doesn't apply to me. I'm not resident in Germany. But the second point, additionally...
But you could move there and the next day you would be resident, you would be eligible.
Additionally, second point, German citizens aged 18 or over who have lived in Germany for at least 3 consecutive months within the last 25 years when they were least aged 14. So that seems to indicate that at some point there's a cutoff. So I can vote, if I've lived here for 25 years... Mm-hmm. Then the 26th year, I wouldn't be able to be eligible to vote anymore unless...
In Germany?
For European elections, if Britain exits the European Union.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
So if Britain exits the European Union...
You've got to go back
for
and live 25 in Germany
years
for 3 months.
I'm living in the UK, I can vote in European elections. And then after 25 years, I cannot unless... I just moved back for 3 months mm-hmm. to Germany.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, candidates. Now, I think that's strange that there's a much more simpler eligibility criteria for candidate eligibility, which is just simply European Union citizen aged 18 or over. So it could be, let's say, 25 years in the future, I would not be able to vote, but I might be able to stand.
Right.
And I think what is strange, and I don't know what the specific eligibility criteria are here, but I think that's the same case here. As a German citizen, I'm allowed to somehow, as far as I remember, I just remember there was a really strange thing about it. I could stand for Westminster Parliament, but as you know, I can't vote for Westminster Parliament.
Yeah, that's right.
But when we lived in Scotland, I could vote for the Scottish Parliament, and I could stand for the Scottish Parliament, but I could vote for the Scottish Parliament because it wasn't perceived to be a national parliament. It was perceived to be a local.
Mm, yeah. I was thinking about that, and I thought the couple of things that hit me was that for those people who want votes for people aged 16 or above, and it's only Austria where you can vote at 16 or over.
Right.
Austria is 16 or over, Greece is 17 or over.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And there were 3 countries which were, it was compulsory that you voted. And those were, I think, Belgium and Luxembourg. I think that's a political thing because they host the EU parliaments, so they've got to be seen to be doing a lot of voting in the in the European Parliament, I think. So in Belgium and Luxembourg, you have to vote. And in Greece as well, you have to vote.
In Belgium, voting is compulsory and failing to vote can lead to a fine of up to €137.50.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a huge amount, but but yeah, fair enough.
Yeah,
I mean, there's got to be a way of, if you have to, there's got to be a something that happens to you if you don't, I suppose.
So that was my second point.
Can I make another thing on another point on that? And that's the fact that it does allow two member states allow for non-EU members to be elected as MEPs.
Yeah, I read that somewhere, which was really strange.
And there are, and guess which one of those is?
UK.
The UK, that's right. So if you're a Commonwealth member and you have been granted long-term stay rights in the UK, then you can be voted as an MEP. But the other country is Portugal. And if you're Brazilian, you can be, you can get elected as an MEP.
So it's all the sort of Commonwealth type of background.
Right.
You know, I don't know what they call it in Portugal.
I think so. So, yeah, obviously Portugal. Yeah.
And I did actually, so can I just ask about that? Because I did note, and I'm just going to read the sentence about eligibility. Each member state has different rules determining who can vote and run as European parliamentary candidates in Spain versus United Kingdom. So in the case, in the court case, in the European Court of Justice case, Spain versus United Kingdom, it held that member states are permitted to extend the franchise to non-EU citizens.
So it must have been the UK saying, we want to be able to elect non-EU citizens as members of the European Parliament. And Spain said, hold on, that's a bit stupid. No, we don't want you to do that.
Right.
And in the end, we won.
Wow.
Which seems a bit daft to me, but...
Well, but on the other hand, we're influencing the European Union. So talk about, you know, losing...
Yeah.
You know, as we said before, losing seats at the table. We're losing 73 seats at a gigantic table.
That's right.
So what was your third point?
I think we were going to talk about your third point first, weren't we? I'm supposed to ask you, what was your third point, Carola?
Okay. Well, my third point, and I'm just going to look.
Yep.
Well, my third point was from the very exciting annex.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, the annex, which is Annex 1, Code of Conduct for Members of the European Parliament.
Oh, yes, of
and
course.
And it's the guiding principles. Because I just... let me just read that. And then we can maybe just ponder about it.
Mm-hmm.
Guiding principles, Article 1. In exercising their duties, members of the European Parliament are guided by and observe the following general principles of conduct. Disinterest, which sounds a bit strange, you know, sounds quite fitting. Disinterest in the European Parliament.
Yes, it does sound a bit weird, doesn't it? But I think it's supposed to mean you have got no monetary interest in what you're doing.
Well, so the other general principles of conduct are integrity, openness, diligence,
Yes.
which basically means being there to work and vote.
One would think, yes. So yes. We have some people who haven't been quite so diligent listeners. So I think our worst person was Nigel Farage with 40-something, who only voted on 40-something percent of the available votes that he, you know, that are put up for members, for MEPs to vote on.
And that points a bit, you know, what's a question that I have in terms of the last principle. But the other principles are honesty, accountability, and respect for Parliament's reputation. And this last point, you know, I find it actually quite strange to consider that you would allow representatives to be part of the parliament that have as a political aim to undermine the existential essence of the parliament.
Yeah, so we're thinking of UKIP in this country, aren't we? But I don't know. Yes, I agree. And that's what they shouldn't be doing. I think they would, if they, while they're not there and impassioned with their what they want to say at some particular thing, maybe they would be saying that they're not there to get rid of the European Parliament, they're there to extricate the UK from the European Parliament.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really sound like that when I hear them talking.
And they've been part of the European Parliament for a long time.
Yeah, when they're talking at the European Parliament, it seems an awful lot of heckling, of rubbishing the European Parliament, of saying how terrible it is and how pathetic it is and et cetera, which definitely would seem to be a lack of respect for the Parliament's reputation to me.
Yeah.
So whether anything has happened as a result of that to any of those members, I don't know. I haven't heard anything about it. And I presume that with the nature of our media, we probably would have heard something about it had that been the case.
Yeah, well, I find it strange because, of course, in the European Parliament, there are parties that would be considered Eurosceptics.
Yeah, there's a bunch of others.
Yeah, and
from memory,
you know, when we were reading up on that, this code of conduct that we were just reading from was established or was entered, came into force in beginning of 2012. And of course, visit, you know, it sets it out that members shall act solely in the public interest and conduct their work with these principles. And I have a feeling that, you know, 2012 was not that long ago. So there was a rising awareness that you needed something to keep the sort of negative forces in check. But did it do that? I guess that's the question.
Well, I think it really hasn't. But they're probably, like you say, they're probably trying to find their feet and they're trying to get an idea of, that, you know, probably somebody says something and somebody says, oh, that doesn't seem right and that doesn't seem proper. And they think about whether to bring that person, you know, smack them on the wrist about it and that sort of thing. And maybe they don't, maybe they do. Mm. And because when we've looked at the code of conduct, when I've looked at the code of conduct, not an awful lot seems to happen to people if they break the code of conduct.
Yeah.
You know, they get 10 days to rejig themselves, and if they don't do that, you know, then nothing much seems to, it's possible that they can be fined and that sort of thing, but it's all a bit, for me it seems quite wishy-washy.
Yeah, and I guess that's the difficulty,
open to interpretation,
because there is an advisory committee, you know, that's part of the code of conduct as well. So there's an advisory committee which gets established at the beginning of the parliamentary session, which also publishes an annual report.
Yeah.
Right. So have we learned enough about the European Parliament?
Not quite, because I've got my third point as well.
Right. What is your third point?
My third point, I think we mentioned the people with compulsory voting. But my final point was that three countries, Germany, Italy and Poland, have kind of a good scheme, I think, where they award the MEPs to each region. So the number of MEPs for each region is based on the percentage of votes from each region.
Right.
So if you have a really high turnout of 95% or something, you'll maybe get an extra one or two representatives in your region compared to some other region that only has a low turnout of 30%, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing that we haven't mentioned, actually, is the actual turnout across Europe, which unfortunately, like with our elections, has been going down and down and down. And I think since 1999, it's been under 50%.
Yeah. I think it was.
And still getting lower and lower. And we are 46%. Some of the worst.
But the UK, I think it's going to be interesting in this election. I have a feeling that we're going to see a
big rise.
A big rise.
Which we would like to see, obviously, but unfortunately that will probably mean we're both Green supporters, and a higher turnout generally is bad for the Greens than a low turnout, because Greens tend to turn out. So we do want a high turnout. We just want more and more and more people to be converted to what we would believe in terms of the Green ideals. So,
yeah. Right.
So
fabulous.
Hopefully, we have learned something about Europe.
Yes.
Let's hope we've conveyed some of that.
And of course,
through the podcast.
If we got anything wrong, listeners, just DM us. We have a Twitter account, Dithering on the Edge.
No, don't sue us, don't please. Just let us know we've got it wrong. We'll apologize.
Yes, exactly. At Dithering E. And you're welcome to come out onto the podcast to correct us online. So if you enjoyed the show, please do leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast player, because it does help for others to find us. Goodbye for now, and have a fabulous week.
Bye.